The following program was pre-recorded, and the views expressed do not necessarily represent those of this station or its management.
We don't need no education. We don't need no thought control.
Welcome to Education Nation, where we tackle the biggest issues in American education. School is now in session. Here are your hosts, Headmaster Rebecca Hagstrom and co-host Mark Durkin.
Well, good evening, and thank you for joining us here on Education Nation. I am your headmaster and host, Rebecca Hagstrom, and it's a privilege to join you every Saturday evening here on AM 1280 The Patriot. And, of course, I'm joined in studio once again by our producer and my co-host, Mark Durkin.
Nice to see you, Rebecca. How are you?
I am very good. Quickly approaching Christmas here.
Only another, 10 days?
I know. Close by.
Yes, it is.
Very exciting. Well, we are going to continue a conversation that we started last week, and we're looking forward to that. And it ties in to our nation's emphasis now on... Yes. Kind of picking winners and losers and rewriting history.
Absolutely.
Yes. So for much of our nation's existence, public schools incorporated a key goal of the First Amendment to create an informed citizenry capable of self-government and political debate. And according to a 1967 Supreme Court case, Keyesian versus the Board of Education, the classroom is peculiarly the marketplace of ideas. The nation's future depends upon leaders trained through wide exposure to that robust exchange of ideas which discovers truth out of a multitude of tongues rather than through any kind of authoritative selection.
Authoritative selection, yes. Being the key phrase, yes. There. In fact, today, one doesn't have to look far to see that there is a violent attack against the free exchange of ideas from the college campus, where conservative speakers we see all the time are being kicked off campus before they can even enter it, all the way into the public square, where across the country, commemorative statues and symbols of American historical events and figures are being torn to the ground. Of course, what comes to mind is Charlottesville, Virginia, just a couple of years ago. There was a big controversy surrounding that. Mm-hmm. So what gives? Well, 2019 mm-hmm. marks the 70th anniversary of George Orwell's novel 1984, in which the main character works for the Ministry of Truth in a one-party socialist state. Now, the Ministry of Truth does not promote truth, but instead it rewrites history to conform to party doctrine. Orwell, he prophetically understood how elites can manipulate history for propaganda purposes, mm-hmm. of course, observing what was going on in Nazi Germany and in communist Soviet Union as well. Well, unfortunately, Minnesota is not immune to having the names of popular landmarks changed or the history surrounding these landmarks rewritten. In fact, our guest tonight tells us that there is an aggressive push to replace our traditional self-understanding as the land of freedom and opportunity with a vision of America as an illegitimate nation that advanced by trampling on victims' groups.
That's right. And joining us in studio to shed light on this is Catherine Kirsten. Catherine is a writer and an attorney. She is a senior policy fellow at the Center of the American Experiment. She was a founding director of the center and served as its chair from 1996 to 98. And Catherine has written on cultural and policy issues for a variety of publications, including The Wall Street Journal, The Weekly Standard, Christianity Today, Policy Review, First Things, and the Star Tribune. For 2 years, she served as a regular commentator for National Public Radio's All Things Considered. She earned a BA from Notre Dame, a master's from Yale, and a Juris Doctorate from the University of Minnesota Law School. Catherine has been a regular guest on Education Nation, and we are so honored to welcome her back on again tonight. Catherine, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Yeah. Well, last week, we discussed the name changes that have taken place at Lake Calhoun and several surrounding streets, and we even kind of learned about the problems that that's causing,
yes.
Even things as practical as getting your groceries delivered.
Exactly.
But tonight, let's turn our focus to Minnesota's most valuable historical asset, which is Fort Snelling. When it was built, and what were the intended missions that were carried out there from this location?
Well, it was built initially after the War of 1812 to keep the British, who were still menacing American frontiers from Canada, out of our new lands, the new lands of the Louisiana Purchase. And there was a particular focus on regulating the fur trade and attempting to keep peace between the Indian tribes that often fought together.
Okay. And that obviously was an important mission.
Yes.
and was very genuine and important. And now we are not really going to be hearing about that important mission that it actually served, are we?
No, we're not.
Yeah.
And you know, we had spoken about this a little bit last week, Catherine, but you know, just for our listeners that may not have heard last week, you had written that after its creation, Fort Snelling had Indian agents at the fort that regularly supplied the Dakota Indians. Describe the type of relationship that the Indian agents had with the Indian tribe, the Dakotas, and how the U.S. government served as a peacemaker for the feuding Dakota tribe.
Well, the first Indian agent was particularly good, Lawrence Taliaferro, who was close to the Dakota, I believe had a Dakota wife, and supplied them with many of the things that they needed to enhance survival, like metal optics. Of course, the Dakota Indians did not have the ability to work with metal, and so he supplied them with guns and knives and other hunting implements, traps and axes and that kind of thing, and also often gave them food and tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of the peace councils, there were more than 200 U.S.-sponsored peace councils between 1820 and 31 between the Dakota and Ojibwe tribes, mm-hmm. who were longtime enemies.
That's a lot of peace councils in 11 years.
Yes, it really is. And again, pointing back to the good that was happening,
right.
That's now being glossed over.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, fast forward to 1862, and Minnesota experiences what you've described as a tragic episode in the state's history. You wrote that the historical events pertaining to the Dakota War and its aftermath have been rewritten, reaching egregious proportions. Before we discuss the blatant misrepresentations, what emergencies were the Dakota Indians facing in the summer of 1862, and how did they respond to those emergencies?
Well, the Indians, of course, always had a difficult time surviving on the prairies in our climate. Mm-hmm. And in 1862, they were running short of food as the animals they hunted decreased in population. Mm-hmm. The land payments from the federal government were late, and there were tensions between the Dakota and the traders, and the Indian agent at that time, his name was Thomas Galbraith.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. So, you know, going back then and just kind of talking about the blatant misrepresentations, maybe we can jump ahead to that then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in fact, the response of the Dakota to the pressures that were starting to build left Minnesotans outraged by the cruel and the barbaric actions that left many people slain. Mm-hmm. There were cries for revenge. So maybe if we could talk a little bit about some of the actions that came that left Minnesotans outraged. And how did the U.S. government then respond after capturing some of the Dakota perpetrators?
Right. So there was a group of Dakota warriors who decided to wage war against the white settlers. And what resulted was a massacre. In fact, it was the largest death toll in a white Indian conflict in the history of the United States. There were more than 600 Southwest Minnesota settlers, many of them around New Ulm, who were killed. And eventually the toll reached 650 after those who died after. Most of them were women and children who had no way to defend themselves. And if you look at the number of whites who were killed at that time, and you if it occurred today and the same proportion of Minnesota's population was killed, it would be 15,000 dead.
Wow.
And that is five times the death toll of 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
It was a huge, huge death toll for the time. And it's particularly tragic that almost 100 of these victims were children aged 10 or under, and 40 of these were babies of two or under.
Oh.
And there were 20,000, I mean, think of it, there were 20,000 refugees in that small population who had to leave their homes, and hundreds of children were orphaned.
Unbelievable.
So in terms of, how the U.S. Government and the state armed forces responded. I want to get all these questions answered. You talked about the brutal way that many of these people were killed.
Right.
And
I
this
think
was
it's important.
About 140 miles. This is the kind of thing that is just simply not talked about, but is well documented.
Yep.
In some cases, babies were nailed to trees by the Dakota warriors and left to die. There are actually graphic pictures of this. I mean, there are drawings of this.
Mm-hmm.
There are children whose limbs were chopped off with tomahawks right in front of their parents, and some of the victims had all their internal organs ripped out and scattered across the ground. And, and one eyewitness said bodies were mangled, quote, to such a degree as to be almost deprived of human form. And that included a woman whose head was left on a table with a knife and a fork stuck in it. So you can imagine there were just desperate cries for revenge from the from the survivors of these murdered victims. And the U.S. government went after the perpetrators, but then they moved to protect the Dakota women and children who were, just as the winter came on or the weather got colder, they were defenseless. And so the Army built a camp over by Fort Snelling to house during the winter more than 1,600 Dakota, largely Dakota dependents. And their intention was to shield these Indian dependents from furious, revenge-minded whites who wanted to kill all of them, and secondly, to feed these Indians so that they would survive through the winter.
Talk about the complete opposite of the narrative that's really being presented.
The narrative being presented is that this was a concentration camp, and that the U.S. government had genocidal policies across the nation toward indigenous people, and this, we're told, is such a genocidal policy.
Mm. And once again, when we aren't teaching history using primary documents, you know the truth because you're going back and you're looking at primary documents. And yet, how many schools are doing that? How many journalists are doing that? Very few.
Right.
Yeah. And so then you can see how the narrative and the history gets completely rewritten. Yeah. Well, in your article, Catherine, you point to the Minnesota Historical Society as the culprit in the rewriting of this particular historical narrative, anyway, as it pertains to the Dakota War of 1862. How did the Minnesota Historical Society website portray the U.S. government housing and treatment of Dakota women and children after the war?
Yes, and I alluded to that, to the fact that this holding camp where the Indians who lived there were free to come and go. They were given generally the same rations as the fort soldiers, and it's a good bet that many would have starved without this. They were given medical care. Nevertheless, the Minnesota Historical Society website portrays this army camp for women and children as a concentration camp, which, as we well know, holds up images of Auschwitz and similar Nazi camps.
Mm-hmm.
And they put it in the category, this larger category of genocidal policies.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that the Indian women and children moved to the camp, they call that a forced march, which is not accurate. Most of them went willingly because they wanted to survive the winter. But it's that kind of attempting to make the white people involved here villains, and the Indians portrayed as victims. That is very simplistic and not accurate.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to imagine feeling comfortable rewriting that kind of history. You know, when you think of the evil that was perpetrated against these settlers, and that the Native Americans were actually protected from retribution by the whites, and then that gets portrayed as evil.
Yes, and it's important to say that many of the Dakota people were not in favor of going to war, and they were caught up in this to their detriment. But I think that the feeling was that these two peoples cannot peacefully coexist on the same in near proximity to each other after such a horrific experience.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, you are listening to Education Nation here on AM 1280 The Patriot. We are continuing our discussion for the second week in a row with Catherine Kirsten discussing her latest article from Think Minnesota, Change the Name, Rewrite History, Redefine Politics, as it pertains to several of the major landmarks here in the state of Minnesota. We are talking about Fort Snelling. And getting back to our discussion about Fort Snelling, we just talked about some of the history account of what took place in the Dakota War of 1862, how some of that was rewritten. Well, in 2017, Steve Elliott, who was then the Historical Society's executive director, ordered for signs changing the name from Historic Fort Snelling to Historic Fort Snelling at Bedote. So by law,
Bedote.
Okay, yeah. Yes. And by law, only the Minnesota legislature can change the fort's name. So how did the Minnesota State Senate respond to this? What was their charge against the Historical Society? And how did the Historical Society respond?
Well, they were concerned about what they called revisionist history for the reasons that we discussed, and they threatened to withhold $4 million from the Historical Society's funding. I should say, first of all, that these signs did go up. They changed the name, as you said, to Historic Fort Snelling at Bedote. And so the Senate wanted the signs to come down. And it's my understanding that there was an agreement on the part of the Historical Society to do that. They did not do it at that time. They claimed at some points the signs were temporary, or that they just weren't really renaming. They just added historical context, et cetera. But eventually they did acknowledge that they couldn't do this, and those signs are now covered, to my knowledge. And you can't see them the way you could see them before. And they have actually launched a public input process to change the name by going to the legislature. I mean, to supposedly see if the public wants to do this,
right,
or at least they'll take under the count as they make their decision on what to recommend.
Right.
Now,
interesting.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry.
No, I was just going to say the name change aspect, though, wasn't that, in a sense, being put forth as to be included, like, in some sort of larger revitalization project? Like, that was just one of the components?
Yes. Oh, so it was even kind of being snuck in there.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Interesting.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I was just going to say one of the things I find interesting is that just a little bit of pushback is causing them to rethink this. Whereas I look at the Lake Calhoun situation, and that was done in a different manner, and there was no pushback at all, and that all just happened with no discussion and no second guessing.
Right.
So it does show that if you do get involved, I mean, we want people on our show to listen and learn and get involved in the political process and what's happening in their neighborhoods and in our state and in our nation. And it just shows you that maybe even contacting your legislature about things like this.
There's no question of that.
You
are absolutely, absolutely right on that. People, if this actually comes to fruition, that they do go to the legislature asking for an official name change, that would be very important for people to make their opinions known.
Yeah. Well, and I'm just saying, even the fact that they pushed back, the legislature pushed back, or the Senate pushed back beforehand, you know, it slowed it down, is what I'm saying. And it's putting it into more of a public process, which is where it belongs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Go ahead, Mark.
Well, we're gonna turn our attention here for the last 8 minutes on the last landmark, and this includes the University of Minnesota. And in 2017, faculty at the University of Minnesota had staged an exhibit which alleged that four campus administrators from the 1930s and 40s had engaged in anti-Semitism, enforced racial segregation in dormitories, or had taken other quote-unquote problematic positions. So take our listeners, if you would, through this case. And did the university end up removing the names of the administrators from prominent campus buildings?
No, which is kind of Rebecca's point.
Yeah.
Good one.
Yes, yes.
No. It was a 2017 exhibit called The Campus Divided at the U of M that was put together by some faculty members and made charges against four former administrators like Lotus Kaufman, of course, Kaufman Union, named after him. People, as you say, Mark, of real distinction, have buildings named after them at the U of M. And there was a 125-page report that a faculty group did after Eric Kahler, who was then the U's president, appointed a faculty task force to recommend whether the names of those buildings should, in fact, be changed. Mm-hmm. There was a fairly lengthy process, a kind of hearing, let's say, at a regents meeting, described by the Daily, and Minnesota Daily, as a raucous affair. And you can just imagine what that was like with students and some activist faculty. But the faculty, the regents pushed back, and they actually did something that's rarely done. Mm-hmm. They voted, before voting, 10-1 against this, they actually started to look at the documents that the task force had claimed supported these charges of anti-Semitism and racism. And Professor Ian Maitland at the Carlson School did some of this work, and he actually concluded that that the documents that the faculty report was pointing to, in many cases, really tended toward the opposite conclusion.
Wow.
And when the regents looked at this, one of them said, quote, the faculty in preparing their task force, quote, were not doing this as an exercise in looking for the truth. They presumed these people were guilty.
Mm-hmm.
So the regents did not vote to rename the buildings. And now this process has been renewed, but there is an attempt to create a process for looking at buildings' names, which didn't really exist at the U of M before this. And I think some of the regents are advocating a pretty simple approach here. So there's a new president, Joan Gable, and whatever will happen under her watch, we'll have to look at closely.
Right, right. That's very good. Well, how do the name changers, these people who generally portray, you know, are the people who are promoting changing the names of some of these important places and sculptures and what have you, how do they portray America's founding principles?
Well, you know, as we know, say changing the name of Lake Calhoun is not going to help the Dakota people or Native Americans today. It is the process generally, in my view, is really about the name changers themselves. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are stages for drama, right? These campaigns, and they provide chances for these self-righteous, often, in my view, self-dramatizing elite to pose, to preen, really, as the vanguard of progress and social justice. So much more caring, so much more knowledgeable than all the rest of us.
Mm-hmm. That's so well put. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, as the left's campaign to rewrite history expands, what will the contemporary version of Orwell's newspeak look like? And what will the end game look like, do you feel?
Well, I think this is just incredibly important, Mark. The left's campaign to rewrite history really threatens to create an intellectual vacuum. And what they're trying to do, I think, is to create shame and guilt on the part of Americans, and in particular white Americans, people who are just afraid to weigh in or to ask to be taken seriously because of the, you know, profound guilt they're supposed to bear because of what people did, you know, 150 years ago. So I think the aim is to fill this vacuum with, as you say, a new version of Orwell's Newspeak. And Orwell invented this term of Newspeak, and it's a language designed not to allow us to articulate the truth in actual, you know, accurate way, but to make it more difficult to think independently at all. And so the Newspeak of today is words like diversity, equity, inclusion. You know, these words do not mean, when they're used by the left, they do not mean what common sense suggests. Mm-hmm. They mean conformity and inequity and persecution of those who disagree. But the left includes a lot of what Thomas Sowell has called verbal virtuosos, people who are very, very skilled at manipulating language and framing the debate by doing that. Mm-hmm. And in terms of the end game, Orwell talked about that, and he said it was the erasing of truth and, as I said, prevention of independent thought. And his very pithy quote about the importance of preserving history so that records aren't destroyed and falsified, books aren't rewritten, which is what basically happens in 1984, is he said, who controls the past, who controls the future, who controls the present, controls the past. Mm-hmm. So if we give our left-wing elites the power to start by chipping away at factual history, right, and imposing newspeak in the name of fairness, we are courting a very dangerous endgame, anti-democratic results.
Mm-hmm. I think Abraham Lincoln, our former president, had a good understanding of this as well, too, during his presidency, when he said that the philosophy of the school classroom in one generation will be the philosophy of the government in the next.
One of my favorite quotes.
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely correct.
So important. And we can't be so busy with our lives that we don't pay attention to these
things.
What's
going on, exactly.
I think it almost just becomes a din when you turn on the nightly news, and these things are happening all over the nation and even all over the world to a degree.
I mean, how powerful are words, though? I mean, when you think about words and what they have traditionally meant, and then when the definition and meaning of those words has changed, you're really on the slippery slope.
Right, right. So we need people waking up and paying attention. Well,
Catherine,
thank you so much for enlightening us these last 2 weeks. We are so happy to have you on the show. And Mark, thank you again.
Always a pleasure.
And if you'd like to listen to this podcast or any other podcast, please go to ednationmn.org, ednationmn.org. You can also follow us on Facebook at Education Nation Radio. Thanks again, and we'll see you next week.